Hey folks, Rob Wolf here with your favorite podcast about new books in science, fiction, and fantasy. I've been interviewing this year's nominees for the Philip K. Dick Award, and I suppose it's a sign of either how slow I move, or maybe how busy the rest of my life is, or maybe it's the proof I've been seeking that I actually live in another dimension, but the actual Philip K. Dick Award ceremony has now come and gone, and I'm still talking to the nominees. But that's a good thing because all the nominees have written fascinating and very different books that are worth reading and talking about. For the record, Ramez Nam won the award at NorwestCon on March 25th for his novel Apex, and Marguerite Reed received a special citation for Archangel. My conversation with Ms. Reed is already available on the podcast, and I'll be speaking to Mr. Nam in a couple weeks. But truthfully, none of that matters right now because with me, through the miracle of Skype, or a miracle to me, who really has no idea how it works, is Adam Rakunas, who was nominated also for the Philip K. Dick Award for his first novel, Windswept. So how are things on the West Coast tonight, Adam?
Oh man, spring has sprung. It is beautiful. Today it was like a balmy 65 degrees here in Seattle.
We had a pretty good day here, too, in New York, but it was cold in the morning. But we hit the 50s. We hit the 50s. That was pretty good.
I know. It's funny how you get through winter and all of a sudden your idea of what's a nice day changes. Like, 50s, oh, that's going to be great after, you know, months of bundling up in the 20s and 30s.
It's true, although we've had a very weird winter here. So, you know, everything's a little kooky weather-wise around the world, nice. I think. So now that your kid is in bed, we can dive in to Windswept. And maybe you could start just with a short summary. And I thought it would be interesting if you started with the title, if you could explain what the title means.
In the world of Windswept, everything is run by three giant transstellar corporations, just collectively known as the Big Three. And people go and sign indenture contracts with them for, you know, in exchange for food and housing and education, all this good stuff. You will go and become a pawn to the Big Three for pretty much the rest of your life in exchange for all the goods. And, you know, if you survive long enough, then you'll get a really nice retirement. And the heroine of the story, Padma Mehta, once upon a time was one of these fast-rising corporate drones. And she was assigned to a planet that grows in genetically modified industrial sugarcane that's strong enough to go and powerful enough to go and power cities and starships and all good kinds of hand-wavy stuff like that. And she comes down the space elevator. She's on this planet, and for the first time in the last 15 years of her life, all of a sudden she remembers just what it's like to be human. And all the people who come to this planet, they call it getting windswept. You get your first scent of the ocean air. You go and you smell the sugar cane out in the Kampong. You go and smell the cuisines of 100 different cultures all cooking at the same time. And you just say, well, forget corporate life. I'm staying here. I'm doing this. And I came up with the whole idea when I was in Hawaii about, oh Lord, 5 or 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago now, I had gone to Hawaii to officiate a wedding. And I had showed up early for the rehearsal dinner, and I had time to kill. And I'm sitting at the bar, and I'm drinking $8 glasses of pineapple juice and listening to this cover band, Murder, the Eagles' Greatest Hits. And I was just looking around and thinking, all these people are here. I could see all the tourists, people like me who were just hanging out. But what about all the people who worked at this hotel and worked at this bar? And, you know, what were their... It's one thing to go and work in a service gig, but working in a service gig in Waikiki when it's, you know, pretty much near paradise. You know, I just wondered what were people's lives like? What would get people to keep staying here and do this work? And what would it be like in the future? Would people just keep on going and working working in cover bands or working in bars and things like that? So I just pulled out my phone and my ancient Bluetooth keyboard and I started pecking away. And I wrote the first chapter of Windswept in that bar, in that hotel whose name I cannot remember now. I probably should look it up because it'd be nice to give them a credit.
So the setting is these three corporations that seem to control everything. And I guess that's a familiar setting in much of science fiction where you have a corporate, dictatorial, monomaniacal, evil-doing, overlording kind of organization. But one thing you don't read about much, which is featured prominently in Windswept, are labor unions. And I was wondering, you know, how you worked that in and if you think they're going to be around, you know, in the future. Everyone seems to think big corporations will be around, but since I haven't seen much of it in speculative fiction, I wonder if you think unions are going to be around when mankind has started hoofing it to other planets.
I think so, because I still think that we are a way off from, you know, the magical Ian Banks culture where benevolent AIs rule our lives and, you know, also to go and take care of our material needs. I think that we are always going to have a giant pool of people who are willing to go and do whatever work it takes to survive. You know, we keep seeing that throughout history as technology improves. And then, you know, I think the cost of labor keeps going down, but also the number of people still keep going up. So as long as we have people, we are going to have, I think, a need to go and keep working. And there will always be these points in history where at first, you know, a new employer will roll into some impoverished area and everyone will go and say, yay, jobs for everybody. And then people will also, then after a while, start to realize like, wait, but these jobs really are kind of poisoning us and killing us. And, you know, we need to get together and demand better conditions. I know like the mega corporation, that's something that's I don't think going to go away anytime soon. Because first of all, you know, they make for really good bad guys. But secondly, I think real life is keeping up with all of that, you know, like the William Gibson kind of things that you'd see in his sprawl books of, you know, these giant multinationals that are more powerful than governments. We're seeing that right now with the fact that Apple has gone and stood up to the federal government of the United States and said, nope, we're not going to go and let you, we're not going to go hand over a back door to iPhones to you. And on the one hand, yay for Apple for sticking up for our privacy. On the other hand, that is still a really terrifying precedent that a company is looking out for people's privacy rights instead of the federal government. In an ideal world, it would be the other way around. But, you know, that's probably a discussion for another time.
The trend that you're pointing to is the growth in corporations. But at the same time, we're seeing, at least in the United States, a real decimation of union power. So, you know, you sort of wonder who's going to win in that struggle. If corporations are around in the next couple hundred years, will unions be as well? And in fact, there was just a Supreme Court decision yesterday that people had predicted would have really harmed unions had Antonin Scalia not, in fact, died. But the 4-4 decision, I guess, rendered the case moot. But there was a chance that unions were going to find it much harder to collect dues. I don't really know all the details. But it made me think about your book and how, at least on Padma's planet, the union life is still going strong.
Right. And that was one of the things, too, that basically, in the world of Windswept, the union does a lot of the crap work that corporate citizens don't. You know, that they're still responsible for, you know, really just going and keeping Padma's planet running. And the big three realize, like, well, we got to have all this cane because, you know, if we don't have fuel, then we're kind of hosed. I mean, I realize there is still a whole lot of hand waving going on to make this work. I really hope that we don't have to rely on, you know, burning hydrocarbons to go and heat our homes and light up our cities, because that's still what the sugar cane is. It's still just going and, you know, it's still going and chucking in a furnace instead of using photovoltaics or wind or tidal or somewhere, you know, a clean renewable energy.
Right.
That's also carbon neutral. That's, you know, that's as carbon minimal as possible.
Well, that's why it seems like, as science fiction often is a metaphor for the way we live today. I mean, the cane culture is a little like, you know, today's corn culture, where we grow corn, you know, and turn that into fuel too, ethanol and corn syrup and, you know, even just corn, you know, I mean, feed for animals. And we use so much of it. And I suppose the same thing is true that occurs in your book, which there's this disease, this plague of black stripe, which is threatening this monoculture crop that everyone depends on in your book. And, you know, that could presumably happen, you know, as it happened with the potato famine, but we're still facing threats like that, because I think there are a lot of monocultures. I think the bananas we eat in the United States are mainly one species, you know, which are vulnerable to particular illness. So that was an interesting choice too.
Yeah, I think I am a big fan of biodiversity and agriculture, mostly because I think it's delicious. I like going to farmers markets and seeing, oh, here, you know, if I go to Safeway, I'll see two, maybe three varieties of potatoes. I go to the farmer's market, I'm going to see eight or nine. And I think just, you know, what on the surface could just be a variety of flavor is also going to be a variety of different plants that could all survive up to, you know, different pests, different diseases. I hope that all the sugarcane that's being grown around the world has some kind of biodiversity, because, you know, like black stripe is a real thing. I just went and pumped it up and sprinkled some genetic engineering magic on it for the book. But there are still all kinds of lovely smuts and rusts and molds that could go and wipe out crops. And if that happens in Brazil, which relies on sugarcane to go and, you know, as a fuel source, not just as a sweetener, like that would just go punch a gigantic hole in the Brazilian economy if all of a sudden, like, oh, well, yes, all of our fuel that we grow, it's now turning to sludge in the fields and we can't do anything with it. So all you listeners out there, support biodiversity, go to farmers markets, eat eight varieties of potatoes. It'll make the world a better place.
And it's interesting because a lot of those varieties of potatoes are actually, I mean, we think about genetic modification, moving the world forward, moving crops forward. But a lot of those, when you go to a farmer's market, are heirloom varieties, things that haven't been grown in a long time.
And exactly.
People are sort of inspired to grow those and are finding they're actually quite good, tastier. I mean, they actually achieve some of the goals that people are perhaps trying to achieve through genetic modification.
Or just plain old, you know, just good old fashioned slow motion genetic modification through breeding. But yeah, that kind of stuff fascinates me to hear about things like, I forget the guy's name, but this one guy in, I believe, Pennsylvania, who was trying to go and catalog and get as many apple seeds as possible for all of these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of varieties that used to exist in America before everyone decided, well, you know, Red Delicious and Fuji and you know, Granny Smith's, and there we go. That's enough apples for us.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, not only do you miss out on flavor, but yes, you're missing out on history. It's important, I think, to know how people used to eat. So we go and connect with, you know, we connect with our culture, we connect with our family, we connect with our ancestors. And that was one of the other fun things to play around with Windswept. Everyone there is an immigrant for the most part. There are some people whose families have been there for a little while, but everybody shows up and they bring the things that are important to them, the things that remind them that they're human. And I think food is just one of those basic elements that help a culture survive. You know, people will get up in arms if you go and mess with their mess with their favorite baguette recipe or something like that.
And food culture, you know, that also, just like a plant species that have been grown the old-fashioned way through over generations, food culture too takes generations to create a kind of complexity that, you know, is complete in and of itself.
Right. It can also get decimated pretty quickly too, thanks to, you know, again, thanks to the magic of giant corporations. You figure, like, well, how can we go and affect our bottom line? And, well, we'll take these two ingredients out and we'll save a few pennies per baguette. And if the loaf doesn't taste as good, well, no one will know the difference. But people know.
Why don't we talk a little bit about Padma Mehta, your protagonist. I mean, I would just say that to me, she's like no one I'm pretty sure she's like no one I've met in books. Maybe certainly no one in real life either, which doesn't mean she isn't believable. But I guess I'd say she's kind of like a female version of a grumpy, noirish detective. But she's also got the physical strength and resilience of a superhero, because she's always being tossed around in endless ways and falling, you know, being dragged up cables and falling 10 meters at a time. And then on top of that, because she's a labor organizer, I was thinking she also has the politics of, just to make it very contemporary, the politics of Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. No, I wrote this long, well, I had known about Bernie Sanders, but he didn't really play it into it. I think you've hit the nail on the head that I really wanted to have sort of a Philip Marlowe noir hero who had gone and, you know, seen it all and done it all, but is still fighting their own little fight, living by their own moral code. I always liked that idea of Marlowe as the tarnished knight, somebody who, you know, somebody who knows that the world is this horrible, corrupt place, and it's corrupted him a little bit, but he will still continue to try and make things right in his way. And I think the labor organizer element, you know, it's a good source of conflict and drama for the first part. And I think it's important to go and be able to cheer for the downtrodden little guy in the face of faceless corporate hegemony.
I mean, and she's an incredibly moral figure. I mean, she's again and again getting screwed over by the people who she either trusts or at least is trying to deal with fairly. And given the opportunity, I mean, these people would happily kill her or see her dead. And when the tables are turned in a moment of crisis in one of the many action scenes that fill the story, she, you know, declines to pull the trigger and do away with them. She's always giving them a second chance, usually to her regret, you know, a couple scenes later, because they surface again, once again, trying to nail her. And once again, she refuses, you know, she declines to do it. So, I mean, it gives her a deeper strength, I think, that she's able to, like, stick to her guns and maintain this kind of moral equilibrium.
Right. Well, I think Padma always has that sense of, you know, deep beneath her battered, cynical armor, she's somebody who has been hurt. I probably not, you know, the book has been out for a while, so I'll just go ahead and give this away just a little bit. So spoilers, cover your ears for a moment if you don't want to hear. But when Padma was coming to this planet, she, as part of an experiment done by her employers, she has some brain damage. She has been, you know, hurt through the carelessness and lack of care from her old bosses. And I think she always is going to, she's somebody who's going to go and see other people who are being hurt and screwed over and has just decided to go make a stand and say, no more, I'm not going to stand for this, even though I'm just one person in the face of this huge company. I'm still going to shake my tiny fist and say, nope, screw you. I'm not going to let this happen to anyone else. And, you know, we see that all the time. We saw it a couple summers ago, to have all these people standing up against armored police officers with tear gas and shields and military-style weaponry to go and say, no, you are not going to go, you know, you were supposed to protect me and my family and my neighbors, and you're not supposed to be an occupying army. You know, it's another one of those cases of real life just getting much weirder than anything that we could come up with in science fiction right now. We're living in some seriously strange times, and I think we have to go and get ridiculous with our predictions and our extrapolations, or just have to write really, really fast before reality overtakes us.
It's like something like House of Cards, you know, you see that, and now, you know, last season, you're like, this show's ridiculous, it's completely, you know, I mean, politics might be corrupt, but it's not this crazy, and now, this year, it's sort of like, it seems kind of tame, actually. I mean, actually, I haven't finished watching the new season, but that's my feeling, you know, that the newspaper is much more, filled with much more wild misadventures of politicians than our fiction is.
I know, the fact, you know, we have a reality star who will quite possibly be a candidate for the president of the United States. That should really be a wake-up moment for everybody.
Yeah.
That should give everybody pause that there is something really, really wrong with not only with America's political system, but with media, education, this, you know, the whole enchilada. We as a populace should not have gotten to this point.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, because as a science fiction writer, I mean, you know, you're obviously interested, and just from what you're talking about, in how humans can act responsibly and the consequences on society and the world when we don't. And I guess I was kind of thinking, knowing that, you know, we couldn't speak until your daughter was in bed. And I wondered if you have changed, and if the things you're most concerned about and want to write about have changed since you've become a parent.
Well, I'm not sure. I've always been concerned about climate change. I've always been concerned about the effect that our carbon-heavy economy is having on the environment. I think I've certainly had a sense of urgency since she was born, that I really want to go and make a point of saying, I want to go and try and make sure that there that my daughter is going to be able to grow up and have the same standard of living that my wife and I had. What's funny is that I certainly have gone from being somebody who writes a sternly worded letter to the editor or to his representatives in Congress to, like, a couple of years ago, I actually went and volunteered for someone's city council campaign when I was still living in Santa Monica. And it would start off as like, yeah, I'll just do a few hours a week, just basically turn into my job for for all of summer and up until election day. Just because I thought, like, well, here's an opportunity to go and work for a candidate who is going to try and, you know, someone who has the same concerns that I do about the environment, about traffic congestion, and all the stuff that spins up from there, and is going to go and try to do things on a municipal level. I know there's that cliche of think globally, act locally, but there is not enough acting local going on right now. And my candidate lost, unfortunately. He really got crushed, which was heartbreaking. But, you know, that's them's the breaks. I know we did go through some other changes. I was born and raised and educated in Southern California, and really kind of stayed in the same 20-30 mile radius for most of my life. And then last year, our apartment building went up for sale, and a whole bunch of other stuff happened. And my wife and I, we upped and moved to Seattle. And one of the things that figured into that was the fact that California was undergoing a terrible drought. And everybody's response seemed to be, okay, well, we'll just turn off the sprinklers and we won't water our lawns all summer. And well, that'll go and fix things. You know, without addressing, like, the structural issues that have brought about, you know, not just the drought, but have gone and kept California's water going towards growing alfalfa and rice, you know, really water intensive crops that are being grown just because those producers have, you know, grandfathered water rates that are ridiculously cheap.
And I remember reading that every almond takes 24 gallons of water or something outrageous, right? And seems completely out of proportion to what you get for it.
Yeah. The almonds got a really bad rap, I think, compared to rice and alfalfa, but yeah, it's incredibly intensive to go and grow all those crops. And on the one hand, I really like almonds. I like almond butter instead of peanut butter. But having an entire agricultural economy based on really, you know, ridiculous water prices instead of what's appropriate to grow in that environment, I think is insane. And the governor and the state assembly and the state senate were not about to do anything to change that, because it would have been political suicide for them. The people who have those water rights are really, really rich. And, you know, they're not about to go and give up their profits anytime soon in the name of something as silly as preparing the world for future generations.
So you're in Seattle, where there's more water. So you're not draining the reservoirs anymore in Southern California, personally, anyway. Your family isn't.
Right. Well, it's also a matter of just, you know, we're moving to a place where the environment is still pretty healthy right now, and I think will be through her adulthood. I don't really know what the next 20 or 30 years are going to be like in that part of the world. I think the fact that the global temperature keeps creeping up and up and up, and we've gone, it sounds like now that governments, instead of saying, well, what can we do to go cut back on our carbon expenditures, are now going and saying, well, we're kind of hosed, so let's get ready for flooding. You know, that nobody still wants to go and take that leap to try and turn the dial back. Everyone just keeps saying, like, no, you know, we like driving, we like eating beef, we like doing all these things like that, and we don't want to change our habits, but we'll, you know, we'll just prepare to go and abandon Miami and every coastal city as the as the oceans rise and storms get worse and all sorts of stuff like that. I know I really should be a lot more optimistic. I should be working really hard to go and change things like that. I know up here, and it's funny, I know you're gonna interview Ramez Nam next, and Mez is on the board of a group that is putting a carbon tax on Washington's ballot. And that, you know, that's the kind of forward thinking that we need to go and start realize that industrial society is awesome, but there is a price that's to be paid. And we're either gotta start paying it now or our kids and grandkids will really, really pay it with interest down the line.
And do you think science fiction has a role to play, just to bring it back to the the field that you practice?
Sorry about that.
No, it's great. I mean, I'm just connecting it because obviously, I mean, this is something you're interested in. I'm interested in too. That's why science fiction writers, you know, write about these things because we're personally interested in them. And so I wonder though, you know, is our role, I mean, it's fascinating that Ramez Nam is engaging in something very concrete and practical today and not merely writing about it. Not that I shouldn't say merely, but I do wonder when there is a certain level of consciousness raising that I suppose can happen in a work of fiction, but I wonder how often that translates into people taking action.
I don't think it translates often enough. Science fiction, I think, has two roles that we go and write the really bad versions of the future as warnings so people could go and see. You know, there's that question of, I'm trying to remember, that Neil Gaiman, once I saw him give this talk where he said that the questions that science fiction asks are what if only, and if this goes on. And we have seen a lot of people writing stories and books that answer those questions. But we also have to go and write the positive possibilities. My friend Yetzi DeVries edited this anthology called Shine that was all about positive science fiction stories. He was just fed up with the doom and gloom of all of these horrible dystopias that he kept reading. And he wanted to go and promote the idea that science fiction isn't just a warning sign. It can also be a roadmap. One of my favorite books is Kim Stanley Robinson's Pacific Edge, which he wrote back in the 90s. And it's an ecological utopia. It's a Southern California where people, I like to think of it as starting to go and build the foundations for the Federation from Star Trek. People stopped trying to go and amass wealth and started to go and make sure that everybody had a decent life to live in. The idea that you know, salaries should go and have not only floors, they should also have ceilings. And what I always loved about that book was people in Southern California embracing the idea that their addiction to cars was killing them. And so like any addict, they admitted they had a problem and they kicked the habit. And all of a sudden you have freeways that are filled with bicycles, which would never really happen today. I think it would take 1,000 people on bikes going and hopping on a freeway at rush hour, and they would probably really, really upset the drivers. But to go and hammer home that point of you can move a lot faster and do the same distance, and okay, you'll get a little sweaty, but you'll feel a lot better and you'll arrive happier on a bike than if you do in a car. And I know that there are some little movements like the critical mass movement used to go and do that, where you go and get a bunch of people who would ride together through downtown. But that also blossomed into something that started in Bogota. They called it a ciclovia, which is where they'd shut down a giant chunk of the city. And it's now open just for people on foot or people on bikes or roller skates or whatever. And Los Angeles did a couple of those before I moved away. And that was a really heartening and amazing thing to go and see 100,000 people on bikes riding around downtown or in all these different places, but turning it like, you know, that's a kind of action, and that's good. It doesn't go far enough. You know, it would be great if we could have a ciclovia every weekend as opposed to, you know, once every 6 months. And that just takes, you know, turning the stories into action, that takes people organizing. And organizing is really, really boring, unsexy work. I know from the little bit I did on my friend's city council campaign, it is really hard to go and call a list of voters and say, hi, I'd like to talk to you about, you know, this issue. You know, what Mez is doing, I think, is fantastic. And I really hope that his campaign works, that his group's campaign works and becomes a model for other states to follow suit. And I think one of the things that we can do to make it work better is going to have to be to go and write the stories that create that roadmap to that positive future, the one that says we are not completely hosed, that there will still be a good, healthy tomorrow for everybody. It's going to mean that we have to change. And some of that change is, you may not like that change. You may not like the idea of having to go and carpool once a week or take a bus. But, you know, I think people have to go and start making a choice of what kind of future they want to have.
I think cars really were the worst idea that anyone could ever have come up with. You know, if someone were writing, envisioning a future 200 years ago, if they thought, well, everyone would have their own little motor and they'd be taking up this much space and they'd all go in different directions. And, you know, instead of envisioning public transportation, tying the whole world together. But then, you know, I live in Manhattan, so my view is completely distorted. I can go for weeks without ever setting foot in a car.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, if I understood correctly from your bio or I read somewhere, that it took you quite a while to get your first story published, and then you worked on Windswept for maybe up to 7 years?
I think so, yeah.
You're not sure, it's such a daze.
I'm trying to go through time. I started Windswept in July of 2009. That was the wedding, I remember that. No, sorry, July of 2007. I finished in July of 2009 on a family trip to Arkansas. So that was, you know, 2 years of writing a first draft, and then probably, well, let's see. I wrote the first draft. Our daughter was, I finished the first draft in July. Our daughter was born in December. Everything's kind of a blur for 2 years after that, because I was the stay-at-home parent. So, you know, I had that dream of like, oh yeah, you know, I will work when my daughter's taking her naps. And I remember every time I would tell that to my mom, and she would very politely laugh in my face and say, "Oh, sweetheart, you hang on to that dream. That it's good to have a dream to sustain you."
Yeah, when you end up passing out yourself, probably when she was napping.
Oh man, it was like she'd be asleep, I was out. But I sent that draft of Windswept to friends. My friend Daryl Gregory read one of the early drafts, and he very politely tore it into tiny, tiny little pieces. And what's funny is that for a while, every time I'd see Daryl, the first thing out of his mouth would be, "Man, I'm so sorry about the critique I gave you. I know that was I was too hard on you." But I'm glad he did, because one of the most important things any writer has to learn is how to revise and how to go and get a tough skin and suck it up and take all the critiquing you get. And yes, sometimes it'll be really silly, but you know, when you have another pro who is telling you the stuff that does not work and how to fix things, then yeah, I think it's good to shut up and listen and then follow through with all their advice. And I was also fortunate enough, not only to have Daryl go and pummel the bejesus out of that story, but I also got invited to a writing workshop called Starry Heaven that was run by a writer named Sarah K. Castle. And she based it off of Charlie Finley's Blue Heaven workshop. And the way that works is that you get 12 writers together, and before the workshop, everybody turns in the first 50 pages of the novel you're working on. Everybody reads all the first 50s, and then you go to the person organizing the workshop and you say, "I would like to read the full versions of these two novels." And then the head of the workshop goes and does all this juggling, and then poof, everybody then gets two full novels to read and critique. And it's really an amazing thing to go and have 11 people give you a critique on the first 50 pages, and then they have two other people give you a critique on the full novel. And my two full readers were William Shun, author of The Accidental Terrorist, and Brad Beaulieu, who is author of, you know, The Winds of Kalakovo and 12 Kings of Sharakai and all these things like that. You know, that was like just as Brad's career was really launching and just as Bill was busy tooling up his memoir there. And, you know, so they went and tore it to pieces, and I went home and licked my wounds and got to work. And then it was still another, probably another year when I finally had the book ready to go, and I started to do the query dance like everyone else. And, you know, again, I turned to someone else who had gone through this, and Mez had gotten Nexus published, and that turned into his deal for Crux and Apex. And Mez is incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for here? Thorough. And he had made this massive spreadsheet of all the agents who represent science fiction writers, all the agents who represent thriller writers, all the, you know, just, he broke all the agents down into great big lists. And then I started ticking through the spreadsheet, just one query at a time. And I was, my own list after I finished it had, I think, 65 agents. And I was rejected or didn't get a reply from 64 of them.
It only takes one, I guess.
It does. And here's the funny thing is that the other wacky thing is that people always, you know, I was always told that the way you go about being a writer is that you write short fiction a whole bunch to kind of learn the basics of the craft, and then you use that to go and build your resume. So when you go and query people, you can go and say like, well, here's all the stuff I've written and here's this book. And I had just made my, like in the middle of all of this, I had just gone and made my first professional short fiction sale to the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And that was after a story that I'd written a while ago. Actually, it was a story I had written for Yetzi's anthology, now that I remember it. And he thought it was good, but it didn't really fit in with the tone of the anthology. And I took it to my writing workshop, this group called the Freeway Dragons, and they beat it to pieces too. But by then I was ready to go and take the beating. And I revised it and sent it off and sold it. And then I got this email about 2 weeks after the magazine comes out from an agent who said, "Hey, I really liked your story. Do you have a novel?" And I said, "Why, yes, here it is." And that was the same time that agent number 65 wrote back to say, "Hey, I really like your novel. Are you still looking for an agent?" And I had to go and it was a tough decision to go and bounce off the two of them. But at the end, I wound up going with Joshua Bilmus from Jabberwocky, and you know, he is gone and he sold Windswept and its sequel. We've got he sold the audio rights, so the audio dramatization of Windswept will be coming out sometime in 2017.
Great.
Yeah, so it's exciting. It took a long time. I think that was, you know, Windswept came out in September of 2015, and I started it in July of 2007. So that's, what is that? I can't do math right now. It's been a long day.
I guess that's 8 years or so.
8 years. Yeah. Yeah. So eight years from that bar in Hawaii to having the book actually coming out.
And did you lose faith along the way ever?
Oh yeah, I had plenty of times where I thought this is terrible. I'm making a gigantic mistake. My wife never let me quit, which is amazing. I hope one day that I can go and, you know, sell. I hope I can sell enough books to help with our retirement.
Well, when does the sequel come out? That I'm sure that will help. That will keep the momentum going.
The sequel comes out June 7th of this year, and the title, and I still can't believe I got away with this, is Like a Boss. My agent and my publisher, Angry Robot, we kept kicking around all these different titles, and I just kind of tossed that one out as a joke. And then Sam, my agent, says, "Yes, that's the one." And then Angry Robot said, "Yes, that's also the one." And I'm still not going to believe it until I see the book in my hot little hands that that's actually the title.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Adam. I mean, I'm looking forward to the sequel and whatever else you've got up your sleeve.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, I've been speaking with Adam Rakunas, whose novel Windswept was nominated for the 2016 Philip K. Dick Award and whose sequel will be out in a couple months. You can find my conversations with the other Philip K. Dick Award nominees of 2016, Brenda Cooper, Douglas Lane, PJ Manny, and Marguerite Reed on the science fiction page of the New Books Network. And in a couple weeks, the sextet will be complete when I upload my conversation, which has yet to occur, with Ramez Nam. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other podcasting apps, and to follow us on Facebook under NB Science Fiction and on Twitter under the handle New Books Sci-Fi. The podcast logo is by Michael Thibodeau, and the beautiful theme music was composed by Michael Aaron. The editor of the New Books Network is Marshall Poe. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe and The Escape. Follow me on Twitter at Rob Wolf Books, if you dare. And thank you so much for listening.